Well, the words of that song go with a lesson tonight. So I think that was on purpose,
yes.
Probably. It's good to be back in Tyngsborough. I've always enjoyed being with you here. And high quality. You know, sometimes the number's not so high, but very high quality here today. So that's what matters more than quantity. Some texts, when you read them, you kind of scratch your head. What does that mean? And yet if you think about them, and if you talk with others, sometimes you come to see its meaning. And sometimes the meaning is a deep meaning. Sometimes it's a very helpful meaning. I want to look at a text like that today. And I remember reading this text as a young man and say, what is going on here? I think I know, and I'm going to try to explain to you what's going on. The text is Mark chapter 8, verses 22 through 26. This is a story of Jesus healing the blind man with two steps. That's what makes it a little bit unique. You only find this story in the book of Mark. Not in Matthew, not in Luke, and not in John. So we'll read through the text, analyze it, and then draw some applications from it. That's the plan. So let's start in verse 22. Then he, we're talking of course of Jesus, came to Bethsaida. And they brought a blind man to him and begged him to touch him. So he took the blind man by the hand and led him out of town. And when he had put spit on his eyes and put his hands on him, he asked him if he saw anything. And he looked up and said, I see men like trees walking. Of course, that's what grabs our attention a little bit. Let's look at these verses and get a little bit of the background. He came to Bethsaida. This is the home of Philip, Andrew, and it looks like Peter had a house there. One there and one in Capernaum. We're talking about the northern part of the Sea of Galilee. Now, we're not 100% sure of where it's located. This is one of the better possibilities. Excavations have been conducted there. Would it have looked like this? That's what some artists, Archaeology Illustrated, thought it might have looked like at the time. This looks like a main type of street going through town. And the interesting thing is they found a house there with instruments that go with fishing. And of course, Peter, Andrew, and Philip were fishermen, so that grabbed the attention of the archaeologists. So, verse 23, he took the blind man by the hand and led him out of town. We see this often in this section of Mark. Why did they lead him out of town? This was a time in the ministry of Jesus where he was very popular. And so, too popular for his ability to go in and out of towns and cities. So often he wanted to perform miracles that would be seen by those who could testify at the appropriate time about them, but he didn't want a lot of this being spread around at this time. He spit on his eyes. Why did he do that? If you know, please tell me after the lesson today. I have no idea why he did that. He did something like that with the blind man in John 9, made clay out of spittle. He put his hands on him and asked him if he saw anything. But here's what grabs our attention. He said, I see men like trees walking. You ever tried to picture that in mind? Would it look something like a sniper? He looks like a tree, or maybe something like that from some movie years ago. What would it have looked like? We'll talk about that a little more in a minute. 25 and 26. Then he put his hands on his eyes again and made him look up, and he was restored and saw everyone clearly. Then he sent him away to his house saying, neither go into the town nor tell anyone in the town. He's wanting you to keep this under wraps. There'll be a proper time to talk about this, but not now. Okay. So, I'm going backwards. Why is this text so difficult? Why did Jesus use two touches to heal this man? Did he mess up the first time he did it? I remember that's, I guess, the question that came to my mind when I read it first. You know, I've had that type of thing happen to me. You take your car to a mechanic and he says, well, let's try this. No improvement. Well, let's try this. He goes up and gets a part that's a little more expensive. Is that what's going on here? That's not what's going on here. Jesus is the Son of God. He's not like my mechanic, has to put two new parts in. He had some purpose in mind when performing this miracle this way by requiring two touches. It's not that he messed up. Sometimes we've made that point with some friends. I think right now of a friend who I had when I was just starting preaching in Kentucky. And he would tell me, we do miracles in our congregation. We do miracles. And I was trying to show him from the scriptures that what they did were not exactly the same thing we see in the book of Acts. He had a studio for photography. I went in and one day he had one of the nastiest coughs. He was coughing. He was congested. I wondered why he went to the studio. I said, you have a bad cold. He said, no, he got very defensive. I don't have a cold. I felt like a prophet, except I would not have referred to the braying of oxen and the bleeding of sheep. Why all the cough? Why all the congestion? No, it's not a cold. I said, well, then why? Explain to me your symptoms. He says, that's the devil making me think I'm not healed. I was healed yesterday. That's the devil trying to make me think I'm not healed. Jesus didn't do that. And that's the point I made with him. But what do we have here? Let's find the spiritual application that Jesus had in mind. So often when you have a difficult text, the context is what helps us. And if you look through these chapters of Mark, it looks like you can almost say we have a theme here. And the theme would be imperfect vision. Just look at some of the things that the disciples saw. Now, the disciples saw some things. They saw enough to leave what they had and follow Jesus. But they had distorted vision. For example, look at chapter 8. And we'll start off with verses 13 and 14. And he left them. They're getting ready to travel on the boat. And getting into the boat again, departed to the other side. Now the disciples had forgotten to take bread, and they did not have more than one loaf with them in the boat. What are they worried about? Food. Have you ever been worried about having enough food? That's something that happens very seldom in this country. In third world countries, yes. Where is our next meal coming from? I remember when this happened to my parents once. My parents, we lived in Nigeria in the 50s. Wasn't that long ago, was it, Mo? But we lived in the kind of the rainforest area, lots of high heat and humidity, mosquitoes. Wasn't a healthy place for European blood. And so the tradition was, according to medical advice, that you had to get away from that for a few weeks, once a year. So that was a tradition. There was a place in northern Nigeria called Jos. It's up on a high plateau. And because it's up high in elevation, it's cool and warm. It's cool and breezy and dry. So the brethren that were there working, they were a group in this time, would take the trip up. Well, it was our turn to go. And someone loaned Dad a little Peugeot, and off we went. But part of the trip, you had to go through a desert area. And the only way to go, there were no paved roads, it's kind of a dirt track. But Dad told Mother, let's do something to make sure we have plenty of water in case something happens to the car. So they got a 10-gallon container for water and put it in the back seat. There were just my older sister and I at this time. And they set off across the desert. And after driving about an hour, about a five-hour drive, let's get some water for the kids. So they look back, all the water had drained out of that container they'd bought. So here we had 4 more hours in the desert, no water. Keep on going, Peugeot. And of course it did. I'm still speaking to you today, so we didn't have the problem. But they were worried about water. And I could tell you a couple of other stories about people worrying about food, but I don't want to cover this up with illustrations to the point that we overwhelm the point. We usually don't worry about food, and here they are worried about food. Why should not they have been worried about food? As Jesus knows what they're thinking, he reminds them of why that should not have been a concern. Then he charged them, saying, "Take heed, beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and the leaven of Herod." What was Jesus thinking about? They've already had one strike against them worried about food. He's concerned about their false teaching. But when they hear leaven, what are they thinking? They reason among themselves, saying, "It is because we have no bread." What's going on? They're automatically thinking physical. Jesus thinking in spiritual terms. False teaching of the Pharisees. Their mind automatically goes to the physical. And we see that around us a lot. The kingdom of heaven is at hand. So he was like, "Get your chariots and your horses. We're going to go out and fight the Romans." They're thinking physical. And even today, the kingdom of heaven. He's going to be king. I'm going to be vice regent. We're going to really physical. Jesus was speaking spiritual. The kingdom of God is within you. Another example. Give, and it will be given to you. What do people automatically think when they hear that? If I give money, and some unscrupulous preachers will say, if you give $100, the Lord will return to you $700. And that's just the way a lot of people think. The more money I give, the more the Lord's going to give back to me. What's going on? Automatically thinking physical. We've got to worry about that. Be concerned to explain correctly the Scriptures. What's going on? Bad vision. Jesus, aware of this, said to them, "Why are you discussing the fact that you have no bread?" He already knew what they were talking about. "Do you not perceive or understand? Are your hearts hardened?" Notice the reference to vision here. Having eyes, do you not see? And having ears, do you not hear? And do you not remember? They had seen all the evidence they needed to believe that Christ could take care of them. When I broke the 5 loaves for the 5,000, how many baskets full of fragments did you take up? They said to him, 12. Probably said that with a little bit of a lower voice. I kind of knew where this was headed. "Also, when I broke the 7 for the 4,000, how many large baskets full of fragments did you take up?" They said, 7. So he said to them, "How is it that you don't understand?" Did they see? A little bit. My Dominican friends say, "Uchin." They saw a dab. They did not see clearly. What do you think they needed? The second touch. Peter illustrates this fact as well. Oh, he could see very well on occasions. In verse 29, he believed enough to say, "You are the Christ." According to Matthew's version, "You are the Christ, the Son of the living God." And right after declaring that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of the living God, what happens? "And he began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders and chief priests and scribes and be killed and after 3 days rise again." He spoke this word openly, and Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him. Who is he rebuking? The man who he said was the Christ, the Son of the living God. Peter did not... Don't you see what you just proclaimed a few verses earlier? Did he see? Very imperfect vision. Peter saw, as it were, men Walking like what? Walking like trees. Jesus said, when he turned around, he looked at his disciple, he rebuked Peter, saying, "Get behind me, Satan, for you're not mindful of the things of God, but of the things of men." In the next chapter, Jesus' disciples, 9 that were left, 3 went up on the Mount of Transfiguration with him, they were unable to heal a demon-possessed boy. And so the father was concerned about this. And Jesus began to talk with him about the power of faith. And Jesus said, "O faithless generation, how long am I to be with you? How long am I to bear with you? Bring him to me." And when he told the man about the power of faith, his response in verse 24, "I believe. Help my unbelief." What's he admitting? "I see." Kinda. "Lord, help me where I don't see." You know, should that be a part of our prayers on many occasions? "I believe. Help my unbelief." One key for him is he's admitting it and asking God for help. That's a key for us as well. We'll talk about that a little more in a minute. You know, when we see these examples of imperfect spiritual vision all through these chapters, and imperfect hearing as well, I think the meaning becomes rather clear. Spiritual healing is often accomplished with more than one step. And the problem is that sometimes we're tempted to be satisfied with one touch and not go from there. We're contented to be with one level of spiritual motivation, and we never grow beyond that to have a deeper type of spiritual motivation. After seeing nothing for years, this blind man might have been amazed. All of a sudden, his dark world opens up and he begins to see the colors: green, yellow, red. It's a wonderful thing. If he had been contented to just stay right there, you know, it'd just be better not to bother Jesus. His things are so much better now than they were. I'm just going to not say anything. How would he have stayed? He would have stayed with imperfect healing. But Jesus wanted him to say something to teach this lesson. And he did just what Jesus wanted. "I see men walking like trees." Something still not right. Jesus wanted 20/20 vision for him, and he wanted the man to ask for that. And that's the way it was with the apostles. They saw some things, wonderful things, but they needed to go back to Jesus for the second touch. And that's the way it is with us so often, isn't it? We see, kinda, but we need to go to Jesus to see more clearly. Let's look at some applications from this. Sometimes we have friends in popular religious groups and they say, "I want to give you my testimony." How do you respond when somebody says, "I want to give you my testimony"? I want to hear them. And so a lot of times the testimonies would go something like this: "I was involved in drugs. I was involved in alcohol. I had all kinds of family problems. I couldn't get along with my wife. Then I accepted Christ as my personal Savior, and all my problems are gone. I'm free from drugs. I'm free from alcohol. I have a loving relationship with my wife." And yet we know, as they're giving us that testimony, that they're imperfect in many of the things that they're doing. They perhaps are members of congregations where Christ's will is not followed carefully, where the conditions of salvation are not taught. In many congregations, they would never tell people, "He that believes and is baptized shall be saved." You will never hear that. I remember one time I heard it, and I'll tell you what happened. I was I was in Paterson, New Jersey. This is not in my outlines. I can get in trouble and get away from it. We'll try this tonight, though. I was in Paterson, New Jersey, and there was a man preaching in the street. And there were about 30 or 40 people listening to him from his congregation. And as he was preaching, he said, "Jesus said, he that believeth shall be saved." But after it was over, I went up to him and I said, "Sir, I really appreciate your sincerity. But why did you leave part of that verse out?" "But what did I leave out?" I said, "Jesus said, he that believeth and is baptized shall be saved. You only said, he that believeth shall be saved. Could you explain to me why you left that out?" And he said, "Oh yeah, I don't want to confuse the people. Don't want to confuse them." I said, "I think you did. I think you, if you don't want to confuse the people, then you leave out part of the verse." So, a lot of times we receive testimonies from people where baptism simply left out of the conditions of salvation. The simple worship that God has commanded from the heart is ignored. And you have what I call the entertainment world model, entertainment-oriented worship. And you have the lasers and the fog machines and the dynamic preacher with his microphone prancing around on the pulpit. They have titles for preachers: Reverend, Most Reverend. And yet, you hate to take a bucket of cold water and just douse those people that are so enthusiastic. Their lives are so much better than they used to be. And you've got to admit it. They are much better than they used to be. I haven't always known how to respond to that type of testimony, but I think here we have a passage we could show them. I think we need to say, "I'm so happy that things are better for you now. You've started the path back towards Jesus," is the way I put it. But let's make sure you're all the way there. Let's look at some passages. Try that sometime if somebody asks you to hear their testimonial. Well, that's what we sometimes say about people who are out there in the evangelical world. But if we're honest with ourselves, we know that so often we're just satisfied with one touch, with one level of commitment, doing what we've always done through the years. Now, everybody that's here, at least most of us, I think, have seen the truth to a certain point. We've seen the need to be born again of water and the Spirit. Most of us have seen the need to worship in simple way from the heart as Christ commanded, without getting contaminated with the idolatry of entertainment-oriented worship. Take that back to basic, simple approach. Most of us have seen that. Aren't there signs, if we're honest, that we still need the second touch? I want to talk about a few, and you'll probably think of some that I didn't think of. Emphasis on external acts, neglect of the heart. Too many Christians are contented with that. Here, we worship according to God's pattern. We do not have an instrumental group here singing with lasers. We don't do that type of thing. Here, we partake of the Lord's Supper each first day of the week. Here, we baptize other people for the remission of sins. We follow the Scriptures in all of these aspects. Here, we emphasize attendance. I used to say Sunday morning, Sunday night, and Wednesday night. I'm learning to say Sunday morning, heavy duty, and then Wednesday night. But and all of these things need to be done. You know I believe it, and I know you believe it. But here's the problem. Even as we do those externals, sometimes we fuss and fight, we worry. The idea of complete surrender to Christ, giving our lives to Christ, sometimes we don't get that memo. And sometimes people who've messed up some of those externals, as we've mentioned, seem a little closer to getting that idea of giving themselves over to Christ and not seeking excuses for a lack of commitment. So, we don't need to be contented or satisfied with just saying we worship the correct way. It goes so far beyond that. Let's correct, worship the correct way. But if we go beyond that and give ourselves over to the Lord, that's going to help the worship. But more than that, it's going to help our relationship with God and draw us closer to Him. Well, another application. Worry. We have already pointed out that we don't usually hear worry about what am I going to eat. We really don't worry about am I going to have anything to wear. Usually it's what brand of clothing am I going to be wearing. You see that sometimes. We worry about how we're going to pay the rent, how we're going to fix the car, especially the transmission go. That's $3,000. What are we going to do? Oh no. We don't have to be overwhelmed by anxiety and worry. God doesn't want us to be overwhelmed by anxiety and worry. We can go to Him for the second touch. And that may involve a number of things. It may involve reassuring of ourselves of what Jesus said in Matthew 6, that if God feeds the ravens and dresses the lilies of the field, He's going to take care of us. Believing that with our heart, even when things may look tough. Or may involve learning to keep our credit cards in the billfold and maybe cutting up a few of them. That may be what it involves. Asking for help for someone to help us make a budget. The bottom line is there's help available. We don't have to spend our lives in worry, especially about money and things of this world. I don't know why I put some of these things on the list. I told Mo, this is a sermon I've preached before. The next one's brand new. But this one's I've preached before. And I think sometimes you preach what you're worried about. And so maybe that's what I did here. But this is a legitimate point. Bickering among brethren. And maybe not so much here in Massachusetts. But I think if down south, and you can tell from my accent that that's where I'm from. Won't try to hide it. Why would I anyway? Anyway. But you see, brethren who fuss and fight. What did Jesus say we'd be known for? By this shall all men know that you are my disciples, if you have love for one another. And I can tell you, in some towns down south, brethren are not known for the love that they have for each other. That's just the sad fact of the matter. They're known for their fussing and fighting. They can't get along. Sometimes brethren who know the Bible backwards and forwards and know the Greek, can quote you verses in the Greek language and even maybe some, even the Hebrew language. They fuss and fight. They need the second touch. They need to go back to Jesus. They need a good dose of 1 Corinthians 13, 4 through 7. They need a good dose of the wisdom that's from above. James 3:17. It's available. It's there. We need to avoid foolish and ignorant disputes, knowing that they stir up strife. 2 Timothy 2:23. Paul talked more about this type of thing with Timothy and Titus than with anyone else. Sometimes young people, young preachers in particular, can get involved in this. We need the second touch if that is starting to characterize us. Opposing divorce while neglecting marriage. Have you ever seen somebody who's just hard line on divorce and remarriage? And we need to be careful, don't get me wrong. But selfishness rules in their homes. They bark at their wives as if they were drill sergeants. I'm thinking right now of one in particular whose name I would not dare mention. Really tough on anybody who disagrees with him on divorce and remarriage. He doesn't know how to treat his wife. He needs a second touch. Unhappy marriages, this goes along with that. Husbands and wives that are selfish. Selfishness rules in so many homes. And I asked an elder, it's tough to be an elder. He said, yes. I said, no, a lot of work. He said, yes. 90% of it is marriage counseling. It's just tough. We're different. Husbands and wives are different. And sometimes that's exacerbated by the fact that we're selfish. We want it done our way. And we can see the defects of others whenever you go and talk with a marriage couple that's having problems. You ask him, what's the problem? You see what she's like. She does this, she does that, she's this, and she, and she, and she. And I think, no, he's kind of right. Then ask her, what do you think's the problem? Oh, you wouldn't believe all the things he does. He does this and that and the other. He's a controller. That's one that usually men get. Sometimes we are too much that way. Sometimes it's the wife that's too much that way. But this is not for a marriage lesson. But you should see all the things he is. And I think they're both right. They're both right when they point out the weaknesses of their spouse. But they're both blind when it comes to seeing their own weaknesses. And they don't think they need to change. I had a husband tell me recently, well, she admitted it was 70% her and 30% me. We try to get those percentage gains. Well, maybe I'm 10%, but boy, she's 90. You know, that just doesn't work. That doesn't work. We have to look first at our own faults and make changes in our own lives. That's going to Jesus for the second touch. Worldly clothing and entertainment. I have to be careful not to make a hobby of this. But we're surrounded by shallow people. People who are completely dominated by the styles and what goes. Now, incidentally, this is the good news from the world of style. Tight pants are out. Look it up on Google. Okay. But the fact that we are dominated by what's in and what's out. If tight pants are in, we're going to wear them. Doesn't matter what the scriptures say about it, we're going to wear them. It's just because we're too affected. We're too easily affected by the culture round about it. It's easy to be affected by their language, by their dress, by their entertainment. We're going to talk about a little bit more about this. I can't remember, it's tomorrow night or Sunday. But anyway, the more we allow ourselves to be affected by the shallow culture around us, the more shallow we become. The less depth we have. We don't have to be wrapped up in the things of this world. The stock market, the shallow show business culture, the revealing clothing that says to everybody, look how shallow I am. And that's what revealing clothing says. Everything we wear talks. I'm shallow, I have no depth. Don't wear stuff like that. We don't have to be that way. Second touch is available. We have to go back to Jesus. Go back to Him. Seek His will. What I'm going to call comfortable Christianity in churches. And it's so easy to get into that nice routine. I make all the services. They would never miss a service. Yet to be really concerned about the lost in the world. Be concerned with trying to find ways to give a card, to make an introduction to our friends, to make true sacrifices. Because sometimes we just don't get that high a level of commitment. The old song, "Must I be carried to the skies on flowery beds of ease?" It's been a long time since I've heard that song. I know Brother Moe's heard it, but Haven's heard it. That's a good song, and it's one for thought. What, must we be scared, carried to the skies on flowery beds of ease while others fought to rend the crown? We want that easy life sometimes, and that keeps us from getting the second touch. How often we see, but then again we don't see. We see, as it were, men walking like trees. And we don't really know what life's about. At least we live as if we didn't know what life was about. How to get that second touch? Just a quick summary. Beverly said one time, all your sermons end up with read more Bible, pray more, and all that stuff. But a lot of times that is the medicine. First of all, we have to confess that we have a problem. And we've already made this point. What was the key in this man receiving better vision? When he said, I see men walking like trees. That was the key. What's the key in our receiving clear spiritual vision? Admitting we've got a problem. Admitting And I'm not saying you have to admit it to the whole church, but admitting it to the Lord and admitting it to yourself. I'm really living as if I did not know what life was all about. Too wrapped up in self. Too wrapped up in the world. Without confession, there's just no healing. 1 John 1, verse 9. If we confess our sins, He is faithful and just to forgive us. And that's where we often fail. Pride won't let us confess. It just sticks in our throat. I need to see better. Acknowledge. Acknowledge that distorted vision through confession and then go to Jesus. And here's the points Beverly said I always end with. But rededicating ourselves to prayer. I'm sure that it's not as important to 21st century disciples as it was to first century disciples. Sometimes I think, why is that the case? And I think in the case of Peter, James, John, and all of them, they saw Jesus. They knew Him personally. They walked and talked with Him. It must have been easy for them. And yet, if we walk with Jesus in His Word, and if we talk to Him, we can become closer to Him, and prayer can become a more real part of our lives. That's the key. Programming ourselves to read the Bible seriously, not just to get up a lesson for Sunday, but to feed ourselves through the Word. Imitation of Christ and His early disciples, their obedience and service. So, brethren, this lesson is designed to help us seek a higher level of commitment. Not to be satisfied with just one touch. I don't want to be a one-touch Christian. I've heard lots of adjectives used to describe Christians before. There's another one. We don't want to be a one-touch Christian. We want to be Christians who receive full spiritual vision. But we have to go back to Jesus for the second touch. Thank you very much. That's what I have for now. And we'll take about a 10-minute recess is what I heard is the plan. Thanks.